is Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. I'm Lizzie Peabody. In 1959, blues was in a funk. The Empress of Blues, Bessie Smith, had died a generation earlier. Here she is singing the blues standard, Nobody Knows You When You're Down and Out.
It's mighty strange, without a doubt. Nobody knows you when you're down and out.
And so one of the main questions was, well, where is the state of blues? And who are going to be Bessie's successors?
This is Theo Gonzalez.
And I'm a curator at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History.
And Theo says in the blues world, a name on the tip of many tongues was Barbara Dane, a promising new blues talent.
Now I got the crazy blues since my daddy went away.
In 1959, she was the subject of an 8-page feature in Ebony magazine. At the time, Ebony was the culture magazine for African Americans. Here's how that article began.
As the rich white spotlight sweeps over the face with the fresh scrubbed look, the girl seems startlingly blonde. Especially when that powerful, dusky alto voice begins to moan of trouble, two-time in Men in Freedom. She is singing the blues, just as Bessie Smith sung them, and Mama Yancey, and Lizzie Miles, and Ma Rainey. But she is white.
You heard that right. Barbara Dane, with her dusky alto voice, is white.
She was an attractive young white woman, but she was belting. She had a voice that was favorably compared to Bessie Smith, to Odetta. And for a lot of folks, she really held her own. And I would say she was making her claim to the music.
For Barbara Dane to receive that vote of confidence from Ebony was a big deal. She was the first white woman ever profiled in the magazine. The article underscores how blues was a genre born of the African-American experience, but adds, quote, through this pale-faced young lady, a lot of dark-skinned people hoped to keep the blues alive and royalties flowing. She toured the country with blues icons like Muddy Waters, Mama Yancey, and Lightnin' Hopkins. She was even booked to tour with Louis Armstrong. But the reality of racism in the United States made things tricky.
A startlingly blonde woman was probably something that a promoter or someone wanted to put on stage in Vegas. But to have black musicians accompany her probably was too much for that promoter, or to have them stay with her in the hotel.
Wow.
In adjoining rooms.
Though, if anyone objected to the company she kept, Dane wasn't hearing it.
Writers would call me a brassy blonde. I thought they meant that I was bleaching my hair, which I was, but they meant personality-wise that I was brassy because I was opinionated in their way of looking at it.
This is Barbara Dane in a Smithsonian Folkways oral history interview done in 2007.
To express an opinion for a woman in the 50s and 60s and 70s even was considered brassy, nervy, too much chutzpah, too much pushy.
There were avenues for women musicians to be presented, and that often involved stepping in front of a manager and having the manager look at you as you turned around so that way he could see what you look like in a tight dress. And she thought, well, that's one way to do a career. And she oftentimes said no.
At the time, promoters had a way of dealing with aspiring musicians who lived by their own rules. They stopped booking her.
So she's had to pay the price. And when we think about the term integrity, we're thinking about it in abstract terms. But integrity also means making specific choices about how you want to be in the world. And that had a very material effect on her career.
Barbara Dane never became the next Bessie Smith. As promoters stopped returning her calls, her chance at fame and wealth began to slip away. So Barbara Dane pivoted. She built a totally different kind of career, one where she made music not for fame, but for change. Because a few years after clubs stopped booking Barbara Dane to tour the country, Fidel Castro booked her to tour his. So this time on Side Door, we tell the story of how Barbara Dane's brassy resolve led her away from American stage lights, down a very different road. The road to revolution. All that after the break.
Whoa, I'm on my way. Glory. Yeah, I'm on my way.
Side Door is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Support for Smithsonian Side Door comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/sidedoor. That's odoo.com/sidedoor.
She knew who she was from a very early age.
Barbara Dane's appetite for protest began in her late teens in Detroit, where she grew up, picketing and singing at union strikes in the late 1940s. Then in 1947, she flew to Europe to attend a gathering called the Prague World Youth Festival.
So she had seen the world at a very young age and started committing herself to a kind of vision of the world that was bigger than just her.
What exactly was the Prague World Youth Festival in 1947, and how did it influence her?
Yeah, it originally was a gathering that brought together about 20,000 students from several dozen countries. And the idea was to gather mostly students in a leftist orientation to a gathering of folks around music, folk song, sports, entertainment.
Being in Europe, surrounded by the aftermath of World War II, was really influential to the way 20-year-old Barbara Dane saw the world.
What does it mean to be a young person in their early 20s, to be with thousands of others, to kind of dream about what the world could look like after all of this destruction? And maybe there's a kind of judgment that maybe our parents, maybe our uncles and aunties didn't quite get it right. And it falls to us to ask the question, what are we going to do with this world when we get a hold of it?
I will pawn you my watch, I will pawn you my chain, pawn you my golden diamond ring.
As Dane's relationship with club promoters soured in the early 60s, the 35-year-old began to blend her singing with her politics. She became a star on the folk and protest song circuit, singing alongside big names like Pete Seeger and Bob Dylan.
By 1964, she was down in Mississippi working as a freedom singer. You know, there are a lot of civil rights workers that are agreeing to go to jails, and they'll have jail-ins. And so the purpose of that is to overwhelm the jail system.
They say that freedom is a constant struggle.
In Mississippi, there were volunteers flocking from all over the country, black and white, all trying to do their part for civil rights.
But while you're in there, you've got a lot of young kids who've never been in jail. These are kids that are walking out of schools. They've gotten some training. But one of the things that you do as a freedom singer in that situation is to sing some songs to keep people's spirits up in the middle of the movement.
Here, Dane really saw the power of music to bring people together. A few years later, Barbara was living in New York City with her small family when a friend of hers who was living in Cuba, a broadcaster named Estella Bravo, invited her to come down on a government-sponsored junket.
But anyway, Estella had kind of gotten herself a mandate from someone in Cuba to bring some singer from the States to represent the concept that when the Cubans were saying Cuba sí, Yankee no, what they meant was Cuba sí and Yankee government no, not Yankee people.
Cuba sí, Yankee no was a motto of Fidel Castro's Cuba, declaring its opposition to the U.S., its government, and its wealthy companies. But Castro wanted to host an American singer on a goodwill tour to show that his revolution, as well as the Cuban people, had no hard feelings toward individual Americans.
But there was a great affinity, a long history, and a lot of love between the two peoples.
But 1966 was complicated. It was the height of the Cold War.
In Cuba itself, 100,000 men were put under emergency orders as they had been during past invasion scares. The waterfront...
But it was a very intense moment when the world could have was within a hair of getting blown up by all this nuclear confrontation.
The Cuban Missile Crisis was just 4 years behind them. Relations between the countries were tense. But when Barbara landed in Havana, she was bowled over by her reception from the Cuban public.
There was a newsreel, cameras, and a whole everything. We were instant celebrities. And I sang a lot of, all over the country, and on the, they gave me a whole night on television. Oh, anyway, it was just a phenomenal time for me. And at the end of it, I had a chance to meet with Fidel and talk about, he wanted to know a lot about the peace movement and the civil rights movement as it was unfolding at the time.
Yep, Barbara Dane met face to face with Cuba's revolutionary in chief, Fidel Castro. The 3-week tour created such an impression on her that she was eager to return the following year, in 67, when Castro and his crew invited her back. But this time, she had company from all over the world.
They decided they're going to have a major international music festival, and they didn't want to call it festival because it was at the time of Woodstock, and they thought it would, the connotations would be different, you know, not right. So they called it an encuentro. Well, encuentro means a meeting.
Officially, it was the Encuentro Internacional de la Canción Protesta. In English, that becomes the International Gathering of Protest Music. The idea was to have a sort of summit where singers, poets, and left-wing revolutionaries of all kinds could share ideas about how to push forward political movements through music. Kind of a, here's what works in my country, how would you approach it? There were a few other Americans, but also Australians, Brits, Italians, Angolans, Vietnamese, as well as performers from all over Latin America.
These people were going to jail for singing, you know, and some of them, well, the Vietnamese came from the front lines there, you know, from singing for the people in battle. Some of them, one of them went back to Uruguay, went to jail for going to Cuba. So this was not Woodstock, go lay in the mud and drink wine, you know, it's not that. It was a different tone altogether.
Before the gathering kicked off in earnest, the singers played a bunch of shows around Cuba. Then they all got together at the famous Varadero Beach. Here's what Barbara later wrote about that gathering. One note, there's a mention of the NLF. You probably know them as the Viet Cong.
When we came at last to the world-famous beach resort of Varadero, we made a headlong dash into the soft blue waves. Small, laughing heroines of the NLF splashed water on the big, serious Argentine. The Australian girl was dunked by an Uruguayan boy, and for the moment, Europeans and Americans, Asians and Africans with such serious work at hand were indistinguishable from any group of rowdy tourists. With the difference that we were all conscious of the tremendous struggles waged to secure our right as peoples of all races and from the lower economic classes.
And I heard Barbara say that Encuentro was important enough to Cuba's goals that even Fidel Castro made an appearance?
That's right. There's a story in which Castro shows up and ends up playing basketball with a couple of the Encuentro participants.
When they weren't playing music or bawling with Castro, the group had long conversations about how to bring this revolutionary fervor and music back home.
One of the things we talked about at these meetings was how can we, we're all doing the same thing in different ways in different countries, and we're all trying our best to unite our various peoples with music, with ideas. Well, how do we help each other do this? And how do we create a worldwide movement out of this?
So Barbara got the idea of starting a record label on behalf of her new revolutionary friends to publish their music on their terms.
I thought, okay, it's time for somebody to just put this stuff on records and make it available. And if it goes only so far and doesn't go to this ocean of people, that's okay too, because a little bit is a seed, and a seed can grow.
Barbara came up with the name Paradon Records. She published the first album in 1970.
Going to the records themselves. The very first one is called Canción Protesta.
The full title was Canción Protesta, Protest Song of Latin America. All the songs on the album were recorded during the Encuentro in 1967. And with the very first track, Paradon Records went big. Just 19 seconds long, but it featured Fidel Castro talking about the power of art to win people over to your cause.
Aquí es como verdadero arte y como cosa capaz de ganar a la gente, de despertar emociones en la gente.
The next track is a song called Varadero, about the beach where they gathered, by a Cuban singer named Carlos Puebla.
¿Te recuerda cuando Varadero era para ricos y nada más? Y por la playa, playa tan hermosa, el pueblo no podía ni caminar.
The song tells the story of how Castro's revolution liberated the beach from American millionaires and returned it to everyday Cubans. The album was accompanied by liner notes, more of a booklet, really, that teaches listeners about the cultures and social movements that the music represented. Since the songs were all in Spanish, Dane included translations as well. The booklet for Canción Protesta also included an essay about the 1967 gathering at Varadero, the label's creation story. And with that, Paradon Records was born. But the revolutionary dance party was just getting started. Coming up after a quick break, Barbara Dane uses spycraft to produce subversive and idealistic world music. Stick around. Okay, so at this point in the story, Barbara Dane had toured Cuba twice, met Fidel Castro, and spent weeks collaborating with left-wing musicians from all over the world. And all of these experiences compelled her to start a record label. She called it Paradon Records. Here's American history curator Theo Gonzalez again. And what were the goals of Paradon Records, just simply put?
The goal of Paradon Records was to document the world's music and politics on record. There are a number of things that are inspiring them to think about politics and music. One was the Vietnam War. Opposition to the Vietnam War was growing.
Beyond Vietnam, Paradon was focused on decolonization and equal rights struggles around the world. In 1970, in its first year of publishing, Paradon released four albums. Canción Protesta, one about Angola's war of independence from Portugal, a collection of speeches from Black Panther's leader Huey P. Newton, and lastly, one called FTA, Songs of GI Resistance. Barbara herself sang on that one. Just for a taste, here's what it sounds like.
The generals ride fine horses, we walk in the mud. Their banner is the dollar sign, and ours is striped in blood. Oh, darn, GI.
The records didn't sell well. But Dane says that wasn't really the point.
Now, our objective was not money. Our objective was culture, moving culture from one to another to another.
To produce the albums and their information-dense liner booklets, Barbara had to find people who could translate the song lyrics. Luckily, she lived in New York City. Barbara sometimes sent friends to the United Nations to look for someone who could translate songs from Arabic, Greek, or Haitian Creole.
So that's how this stuff, all of this gets done, is just spit and chewing gum. You know, you just got to figure out, how am I going to connect with somebody who can handle this aspect?
Occasionally, Barbara published songs or even entire albums that she didn't really have permission to use.
No, my motto really has always been is if it has to be done, if it's in human terms, something that has to be done, you just find a way to do it.
Dane recalls one album that was sent to her from Northern Ireland during that country's violent civil war.
I never met those people, any of them. I contacted them through clandestine methods. They contacted me, and we put it out. I didn't have a name for the group. I made up a name, because one of the phrases that kept coming up was Men of No Property. So I said, okay, they're the Men of No Property.
Oh, come every soldier, be sure I have told you, the people in this country hold you for the blame. If it's flying or rowing, as long as you're going, and never come back to old Ireland again.
Or the music from Chile, which was then under the brutal dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet.
Someone got in touch and said, we have this album, we want to put it out. So I had to meet someone in a coffee shop with my whatever scarf on that they would recognize. They gave me the material. It was all done that way. I never knew the name of the person who brought it to me. As I recall, he was missing the joint on a finger. Someone who had been tortured. And so that there is that element in running through the whole label.
These musicians were taking great personal risk to have their music put out in a way that told the world what was really going on in their countries.
In it, you'll find the voices the thoughts, the fears, the hopes, the dreams, all of that is in one little album.
In the ocean or Estevez, those beneath the sea.
Peridon Records also focused on oppressed groups inside the United States. In 1973, they published an album called A Grain of Sand, Music for the Struggle by Asians in America. Here's lead singer Nobuko Miyamoto.
And I'm a third-generation Japanese-American born in Los Angeles.
Nobuko's life growing up in the United States was marked by a lot of traumas.
I was a child of Japanese relocation, so I experienced going to a concentration camp with my people, 120,000 others. And that experience was a marker in our lives.
Consider the time in which Nobuko was growing up in the U.S. She lived through World War II, then the Korean War, and then Vietnam.
Which was sort of a wake-up, the third war that I'd seen in my lifetime that was against people who looked like me. And it was the first time that Asian Americans, Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans, Korean Americans realized that we needed to come together to take a stand against this war.
To band together in the face of another bloody American war in Asia, Nobuko and her friends worked to create community and build pride around their identity as people of Asian descent living in America.
We're a small community. But at that period in 1969-70, we realized, well, we can't just fight as Japanese Americans or Chinese Americans. That's when Asian America happened.
Sons and daughters of the railroad builder leave their stamp on America.
During these community gatherings, Nobuko played music for morale and solidarity. She ended up playing in a band with two other activist musicians. They called themselves Yellow Pearl. One of the songs they sang gave voice to what it was like growing up in the U.S. This song is We Are the Children from the album A Grain of Sand.
Cowboys and Indians ride, red men ride. Hey, watching war movies with the next door neighbor, secretly rooting for the other side.
But unlike some of the other albums published on Peridon Records, Nobuko doesn't think of A Grain of Sand as protest music.
It's really an album of coming to voice for Asian Americans. If we were speaking to the white world, it would be more of a protest album, but we were speaking to our own communities who had not had a song, who had not had a voice, a political voice.
We are the cousins of the freedom fighter, brothers and sisters all around the world.
So that idea of what Asian American had to be invented, it had to be talked into existence and it had to be sung into existence. And this album helped to provide that. It was really the first album to describe what it would mean for an Asian American consciousness to develop. And it still is important for a lot of people today.
Despite this album's importance, Nobuko says the process of recording it wasn't exactly luxurious.
Yeah, it was very working class. We did everything in 3 days. We never did any more than 2 to 3 takes. Most of it was the first take. And plus, she didn't have money for us to spread it out. You know, we say, oh, wait, can we do that one more time? Oh, no, that sounds fine. Like, We're the Children, you know, Chris's voice cracked on something.
That's her bandmate, Chris Ijima.
And he wanted to do it again, and she said, no, that's fine. And then later, he went back and listened to We Are the Children, and he actually said, oh, that was my favorite part when my voice cracked.
Another singer recording with Peridon was Argentinian Suni Paz. She says it was the first time she'd recorded anything. Like Nobuko, she was an activist and teacher, not a professional musician. Paz recorded her album Brotando del Silencio with Peridon in 1973. And she remembers recording with Barbara Dane as a bit intimidating.
First thing I got to tell you that she never liked my voice. She always criticized my voice. She said, you have to open your mouth more or breathe better. She was very blunt in her criticisms.
While Dane knew what she wanted out of Suni's voice, she gave her the freedom to curate the album's message.
She gave me full and total, complete freedom. And I asked her, I said, look, I have this crazy poem, but I want to do it as a poem because it doesn't have music. This is not a song. It's a poem. And she said, yes, no problem.
Los dos nacieron reyes, soberanos indisputables de espacios, sin dueños ni fronteras, en profunda armonía con el mundo y los ritmos secretos de la tierra.
This is Suni's poem, Indio y Negro, about the parallel plight of Native Americans and formerly enslaved Black people in the Americas.
So it came out really beautiful. I think it's a gorgeous recording. I personally love it.
Following her debut on Peridon Records, Suni Paz went on to record 32 more albums.
Partiendo de una misma concepción del mundo, de la tierra y el tiempo.
And really, it's this community-minded approach that defined Peridon Records. But after a decade of grinding, in 1981, Barbara wanted to move back to California to dust off her career as a singer, and Peridon took a lot of time. So Barbara recruited a team of people to keep Peridon running.
So we did turn it over to a collective. The collective worked very hard and kept it going for 3 or 4 years, I guess. But it became clear that without the travels and the connections that I was making through the travels, it was impossible to find the material, to build the trust.
And so by 1985, after releasing 50 albums showcasing protest and anti-colonial movements on 6 continents, Peridon was over. But the ideas that Peridon showcased were still out there. Here's founding director of Smithsonian Folkways Records, Tony Seeger. And he says, sure, they were out there, but you couldn't walk into most suburban record stores and find them on the new release rack.
The influence of Peridon Records, I think, was probably somewhat restricted to people who could find them. Today, you can find almost everything on the internet if you search for it. You may have to go to some strange corners. But at the time, if you lived in most of the country, there was no strange corner in your town that you could go to where you could find Peridon Records.
Seeger says that Peridon was popular with groups of musicians who would buy the music, learn a few songs, and then pass the albums on to their friends. It was a way to circulate ideas while keeping costs down.
And I think that's an important part of what was happening in the pre-internet era, was that you had a lot of fairly radical songwriting being done and a lot of wonderful performances from around the world of protest and struggle and singing against injustice, whose impact was partly through the musicians who heard it and then carried the songs along and taught them to other people.
This was Peridon's real power. It wasn't only about the songs that Peridon published. It was also about the songs that it inspired. And Seeger says that Peridon was also a witness to history. All of this pushed Seeger to acquire Peridon Records in 1991 for preservation under the Smithsonian's roof.
Barbara Dane was passionate about the music of the struggles for decolonization and justice in the world. And I thought that was a really important part of the history of the 20th century.
And that's why, with Peridon, Barbara Dane created a critical testament to the political movements and music of the post-colonial era. As for her career after Peridon, Barbara Dane returned to one of her earliest loves, blues music. Since then, she's released 4 albums. Some new jazz and blues recordings, as well as a few featuring songs that had never been published from her heyday as one of the heirs apparent to the Empress of Blues.
Now keep your eyes on the prize and hold on, hold on, hold on.
You've been listening to Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. And right now, Smithsonian Folkways Records is celebrating 50 years of Peridon. They've built a Peridon portal on their website. If you want to hear more music or read about the label's history, there's a link to it in our episode notes, as well as on our website at si.edu/sidedoor. For more stories of important American women, be sure to look into the Smithsonian American Women's History Initiative. To learn more, go to womenshistory.si.edu or join the conversation using #becauseofherstory on social media. We interviewed a lot of people for this episode. We want to extend a special thanks to everyone who helped make it happen. Theo Gonzalez, Nobuko Miyamoto, Suni Paz, Nina Menendez, Tony Seeger, Bev Grant, Javier Leon, and Allison Leitner. Thanks also to everyone at Smithsonian Folkways for their guidance and support, including Meredith Holmgren, Jonathan Williger, Jeff Place, Kim Sojin, Logan Clark, David Walker, Cecilia Peterson, Greg Adams, Dan Sheehy, Charlie Weber, and Will Griffin. Our podcast team is Justin O'Neill, Natalie Boyd, Sharon Bryant, Anne Cananan, Caitlin Schaefer, Jess Sadek, Tammy O'Neill, and Lara Koch. Extra support comes from Jason and Genevieve at PRX. Our show is mixed by Tarek Fuda. Episode art is by Dave Leonard. Our theme song and other episode music are by Breakmaster Cylinder. If you want to sponsor our show, please email sponsorship@prx.org. I'm your host, Lizzie Peabody. Thanks for listening.
Support for Smithsonian Side Door comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/sidedoor. That's odoo.com/sidedoor.